This is Other Plans, and I'm your host, Abby Gerke. My guest today is Vince Savage. Vince is the executive director of the Aspen Homeless Shelter. Today, we'll talk about his lifetime of work in social justice, joining the civil rights movement with Martin Luther King, his work in humanistic psychology, and of course, his work with the homeless population here. I hope you'll listen. Do the job for free when you need. Monday was Martin Luther King Day, and that'll be the center of our conversation. But first, I have to ask what it was in your upbringing to launch such an incredibly varied path through life. You grew up in Indiana, professor's kid, Martin Luther King at the Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, to helping drug addicts in the Canadian Arctic. You taught at the University of Colorado, and you have a PhD in psychology. You provided aid in the Middle East after the Six-Day War, and now you run a homeless shelter here in Aspen. So what do you think it was in your upbringing to have this varied path through your life?
Well, I think that growing up the way I did is a little bit schizophrenic, to misuse the term, because Indiana is the furthest northern southern state, if you know what I mean by that. Mm-hmm. If you look at the maps of the red states and the blue states all the time in these election times, Indiana is invariably voting with the South. However, I grew up on this little island of multiculturalism called Indiana University, which is a remarkable liberal arts school. I guess sometimes when you grow up without a completely homogenous surrounding you, kind of, you know, completely homogenous surroundings, you start to think more relatively, you know, like, well, it depends on who I'm talking to, what truth is, or depends on who I'm speaking with or being with, what's important. So I think maybe something like that had some of the underpinnings of, you know, why I look at things the way I do.
Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was the assistant pastor with his father at the Ebenezer Baptist Church from 1960 up until his death in 1968. How did you get there?
Well, it had to be around 1960. I don't remember the exact dates of when the Poor People's March on Washington started, the first one, but I think it was 1965 or 60. And, you know, like the kid would watch the news from the time I was 3 years old. I think we were the first people in our neighborhood to have a television set. So, you know, I was always, you know, probably somewhat aware of what kind of national issues were going on. And, you know, during the civil rights issue that stretched from the, well, forever really, but especially came to a point in the 50s. And through the early 60s, I was always kind of aware that, you know, there was some grave injustices by my standards going on in the world. And so at some point, I decided it would be interesting to go down and try to help.
And how old were you when you went there? And how did you get there?
I think I was 17 or 18, and I had a little 61 Volkswagen Beetle convertible, which was, you know, the proven, you know, transportation of choice for radical young college-type students. So, you know, that was the logical thing to do, was to get in there. And back then, gasoline was like 27 cents a gallon, if you can believe that. So for $5.50, a buddy of mine and I could drive from Bloomington, Indiana, all the way to Memphis or Point South in Mississippi. That was pretty cheap way to go.
And so you were at the end of high school, or were you in college?
I think I was ending high school. Probably, like, my idea of a senior trip was to go down to the South and help people with voter registration and other civil rights work like that.
I was going to ask next, what did you do there? And so you helped with voter registration. What else did you do?
Well, we did that sort of thing, but we also were just down, you know, kind of pushing the issues around racism and segregation. And one of the big issues at the time was still segregated lunch counters, segregated bathrooms, and that sort of thing. And so, you know, we were just there to help out, and we were actually registering people to vote. But we were also doing a lot of social activist meetings and community organizing.
And did you personally interact with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.?
Yeah, when we were doing organizing kinds of trainings and things like that, Dr. King would come by, spend some time. We did role playing and stuff. Like, how do you respond nonviolently to people shouting at you or calling your names, things like that. So he was involved with that, as well as his assistant, a fellow named Ralph Abernathy. And then over the course of all of my civil rights work, you know, I got to know Jesse Jackson and Andrew Young and a number of, you know, people whose names later kind of became famous in the civil rights era. Of course, you know, we didn't know how well they're going to become known at the time, because we were just there for a mission and a purpose. We weren't there because these were famous people.
Right, and I actually just read an opinion article in the New York Times about just that, about how it's really important to obviously remember the people, Dr. Martin Luther King, Jesse Jackson, but also it's almost more important to remember and think about the movements and the movement today and how it compares to the movement then, the civil rights movement in the 1960s, and how maybe it's better to not iconicize these peoples as just one person and rather a whole movement like Black Lives Matter. What do you think about that?
Well, absolutely. And the thing is, I think even more than that, people are driven by what's going on internally with them. It's not so much the outer manifestations of a movement, but the fact that when you're 17 or 18 years old and you've been raised, you know, to think about things from several different perspectives, you know, it's very attractive to go out and get involved with other people who are having the same questions you are. You know, like if this is a free country, if the motto of American democracy was always one person, one vote, and then you see something happening like voter suppression and people trying to make getting registered to vote even difficult, you know, it just brings up people's outrage and unfairness. Because most children, I believe, tend to be rather idealistic. And so as you begin to reach your teens or go to college and get out in the world a little bit on your own, you begin to see discrepancies between the ideal and what seems to be the practice. And so I think it's a natural tendency to say, hey, this is wrong. I'm going to go help right where, you know.
In a photo I saw, I think it was in an Aspen Times article, I saw at least one time you had a large photo of the Dalai Lama in your office.
Yeah.
I know that Dr. King nominated a Vietnamese Zen Buddhist priest for the Nobel Peace Prize in 1967, and in a letter he said that the two were friends. Can you tell us anything about that or anything about Dr. King's depth of knowledge or interest in Buddhism?
I think that Dr. King was interested in any kind of peaceful paths to power. So he made a point of, you know, talking about the Dalai Lama, Gandhi, you know, and he kind of patterned his nonviolent protest movement after the same kind of things that Gandhi did with the British, where, you know, you make your beliefs felt. You even could interfere with the workings of government, but not in any violent way. You know, the whole concept about sit-ins and people that go on fasts, hunger fasts, and things like that was all part of what Gandhi was about. It's like, we're not going to win by fighting people physically, but secondly, we're no better than the people that are doing violence to us if we use the same tactics against them. I mean, that's a trap. So that was one of the hallmarks of the civil rights movement in far as SCLC, Southern Christian Leadership Conference, was about. It varied from some of the other movements like the Black Panthers and SDS, who took over buildings and, you know, made their protests known in a more, I guess you'd say, more vibrant way.
You're a psychotherapist. I've read several different terms associated with your practice. I've read humanistic, gestalt, client-centered. Can you tell us a little bit about how you think the mind works and what do you think the role of a therapist is?
That's an interesting thing to bring up because there's a term called neuroplasticity. The neuroplasticity of the brain is the tendency of the actions you take cause your brain to fire in certain pathways. And when people's brain fires in certain pathways, it tends to build those pathways. So the truth is that, and it's a relatively new idea, that whatever you decide to do to behave actually increases your ability to behave that way in the future. So it's a little bit like driving on a road that's kind of humped in the middle. If you get a little bit off to one side of the center, your tendency is to keep going that way because gravity and other forces, centrifugal force and stuff, keeps that happening. So as a metaphor for how people decide what they're going to do with their lives, I think that has a lot to do with it. It's the experiences that teach you. One doesn't generally learn or decide to behave differently because they read in a book that it was a good idea. I think it more commonly happens that you have an experience where you're afraid of another person, you get closer to them, and then at some point you realize, oh, they're not so scary, they're fine. So if you grew up in an environment where everyone around you was scared of another race, for example, then you might become kind of convinced or ingrained with that notion that people that are different from yourself, the concept they call the other, is a scary concept, whereas other people may see that people of different races, different backgrounds, different countries of origin, different cultures are more interesting than just your average particular neighbor. I think you develop these habits, and the habit builds upon itself.
And so is humanistic psychology the therapist's job to introduce their client or their patient to those new neuropathways?
Well, in a way, that's correct. People learn not from ideas so much as they learn from experiences. So the thing called gestalt therapy, a lot of therapies, the person comes in and they're worried or they're upset or they're not feeling good, and the therapist tends to intellectualize with them about it. Like, well, maybe you feel that way because your father was absent or your mother was abusive or whatever, you see. Mm-hmm. And they try to figure it out with the frontal lobes, what's the logic behind why I am the way I am, with the misconception that by understanding why you're having issues or why you are the way you are, that understanding alone is going to help you change it. Whereas Gestalt therapy doesn't feed back ideas to people. They actually feed back an experience, and then you see where that experience leads you. It also has a lot to do with your own individual choice as a human being. The humanistic credo is that people have choice, and they have the freedom of choice behind how they're going to behave, whereas a behavioristic approach, which is sometimes typified by putting the rubber band on your wrist, and every time you have an urge to light a cigarette, you pull the rubber band back and snap it against your wrist, which kind of hurts. So you're sort of, behaviorism believes that you're sort of associating pain with the thought of having a cigarette, and that ultimately conditions you to not want the cigarette. Whereas the humanists don't do that at all. They feel like, what's going on every time you reach for a cigarette? Are you really looking for some kind of other nourishment by putting the cigarette to your mouth?
You have your PhD in psychology. What was your dissertation?
Well, actually, my doctoral dissertation was developing a training model for people with Gestalt therapy, how to actually teach people how to develop into Gestalt therapists.
And so the Gestalt therapy practices are how you approach people with problems. And do you use this with yourself, I guess?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I definitely find that, getting in touch with your emotions and expressing your emotions, again, in a safe and appropriate way. But one of the advantages of Gestalt therapy is you don't really have to have the person that you have an issue with there, because the issue isn't really with them in body anyway. The issue is with your perception of them. So that opens up the advantage that people can, in Gestalt work, get mad at a parent that died 20 years ago for something, and to get mad with them for something that that parent did wrong or never did, because it's about resolving the issue within you, not with the other person. Because generally speaking, people don't change the way we'd like them to, as a rule. They kind of change the way they need to change. So it makes it a very utilitarian kind of approach. But at the same time, it's scary because people are afraid of their emotions. And so it takes a certain, takes a certain building of an environment, a safe environment. In fact, what Gestalt people call it is the safe emergency. And by a safe emergency, they mean, what are the conditions that make it safe for you to let your true emotions emerge? That is really the key to mental health, is having the courage to get in touch with what's true for you and see where that leads.
You're also the executive director of the Aspen Homeless Shelter. How long have you been in your position there?
Oh, it's hard to nail down when it started. At the time of Katrina, we started a thing called VIA, V-I-A, which stood for Valley Information and Assistance, which was intentionally vague, because what we were about was helping a lot of Katrina refugees, from New Orleans. So I started with that, and then somewhere within the first 3 or 4 years, I somehow morphed over into becoming the director of the homeless shelter around 2008 or 2009. So we've been in existence as a 501c3 not-for-profit ever since 2009.
How, at the Aspen Homeless Shelter, and in general, in your opinion, how do you think the homeless population here has changed or stayed the same throughout your tenure?
Well, I don't know about my tenure, but I know from back in the 60s, there were a lot more ski bum hippies around who were, I think, in some ways accepted, partly because of the times and just the sheer numbers of people here that you could have called ski bums at the time. But as Aspen has evolved into more and more of a prestigious, high-cost place to be, I think the homeless population and the so-called hippie fringe group people have felt a little bit more pushed out. And there's a saying that I encountered when I first came here, that the billionaires were pushing the millionaires out of Aspen and pushing them down Valley, which I don't know whether that's humorous or not, but it may be true. But change is everywhere. Like they say, the only constant is change, and your ability to adapt to change, artfully, hopefully, is one of the measures of success. People who are rigid tend to not deal too well with change. And one of the metaphors for that in my Buddhist practices is a living branch, that's green and has leaves on it, tends to sway in the wind. A dead branch tends to be much more rigid, but if you try to bend it, it won't bend with the wind, it'll snap. And that's a great metaphor for people who are thinking rigidly and the inability of them with their rigid thinking to adapt to change. Whereas if you're truly living, you still got leaves, you've got sap running through your veins, then you tend to sway with the breeze a little bit more and probably survive.
In other interviews, too, you've mentioned that many people are surprised to learn that there is a homeless population in Aspen. Why do you think people are unaware of this?
For a couple of reasons. They don't expect that in a place like Aspen because, the mythology is everybody in Aspen is both beautiful and rich, right? But we all know that's not 100% true. And another reason is because we exist. The fact that we have these programs to feed people, give them a place to do laundry, use a computer, sometimes get them cell phones, give them a place to congregate other than on the street somewhere, and try to help them with getting the things they need through more conventional routes than just standing on the street corner with flying a sign, as they say, saying, you know, anything helps, blah, blah, blah. So I think surprised that our homeless are here, but they aren't in the usual roles that you see sometimes on every street corner or every highway exit, you know, ramp. He's somebody that's, you know, begging for, you know, some help. So the fact that our programs exist have a lot to do with why people don't necessarily know that there's a lot of homeless people here. And hopefully the purpose of doing all this is not just to make life so easy on them, but to give them a little breather so that they can actually have a little energy to direct toward, okay, I lost that job. Maybe nobody's hiring in that area at all, but what can I do that would earn me a living, you know? So it's like giving people what we call a leg up or a hand up instead of a hand out.
And during the pandemic, what has been the most challenging? Your job is obviously really challenging, but during this time, what is the most challenging part of your job?
Well, there's a couple of layers to answer that question. The people on the front lines, the people at Catholic Charities, our organization, another one called Feed My Sheep, have years, if not decades, of experience of dealing with people who are homeless and living on the streets and are therefore somewhat stressed. One of the big challenges is dealing with government officials, let's say, federal people who want to help the homeless problem and throw a lot of money at it. But with that comes a lot of requirements on record keeping and accountability rather than just pure trust. They want you to document everything you do. And sometimes the amount of time spent on documentation exceeds the actions that you want to perform mm-hmm. to actually help the homeless. So that's one layer of difficulty. The other layer of difficulty is just your job being to be in constant contact with folks that are often stressed out more than the average worker be, you know?
Obviously, one of your duties is development, raising funds to operate the shelter. How do you go about that?
Well, some of our money comes from the county, from the Health and Human Services budget, and something called the Healthy Community Fund, which was started many years ago here, to help all kinds of not-for-profits. So some of our funding comes from that. But a majority of our funding comes from private individuals that are generous and private businesses. We have as a result, we have a fairly high level of functioning in our population of people who are homeless here. I mean, you wouldn't necessarily know that our people are homeless because they don't all present the same way maybe really chronic homeless in urban areas present. Although there's a few that you could take a look at and look at their backpack and look at their tan that shows they've been living outside for years and think, I bet that person's homeless. Mm. But not necessarily. They could just be somebody who skis every day, you know, and
right.
likes to carry a backpack. So, you know, it's hard to tell.
And what can one do to help if one can't donate a large sum of money?
Well, you know, it's funny. I just heard from our director of development today that we have like over 1,000 donors in just the last year. And sure, we appreciate people who can give a lot of money, but it's actually really nice to know even those people that are just working folks that are scratching out a living here, you know, for them to give $100, that's great. You know, we know that's a sacrifice for them and it shows kind of where their heart is. So, and we have a lot of people that want to volunteer too. They have more time on their hands than they have spare change. So, you know, they decide, well, I'm going to come in and help go pick up food at the grocery stores that are donating their stuff to us. And people can do whatever they want, you know, even if they just smile and wave as they go by or, you know, treat one homeless person with a little more respect than they might have before. That's enough, too.
Do you have any parting thoughts on the legacy of Martin Luther King?
I'd say Martin Luther King's attitudes about the arc of history moving towards justice is something that still remains to be seen. You know, how much is the arc of history moving toward justice? Frankly, my personal beliefs are the experiences of the last 4 years have given rise to a lot more consciousness and a lot more awareness that there's plenty of work still to be done on helping people become less racist.
Vince, thank you for talking to me, and thank you for your work in the Aspen Homeless Shelter and your life's work of social justice.
Well, I'll tell you, thank you. And it may seem like a big sacrifice to do this kind of work, but frankly, it's very rewarding to get down on street level with people. And, you know, when somebody thanks you for just giving them a meal, you know, that's really heartrending, you know. So, yes, thank you. You're welcome, you know. Come back tomorrow for another meal.
I don't want to do your dirty work no more. I'm a fool to do your dirty work. Oh, yeah.